This is Uncouth Ruth, and you're listening to Cave of Solitude.
Welcome, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you on location in the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and with me today, I am proud to have our special guest, local talent, local legend, I will say, artist extraordinaire, Mr. Sean Daly. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
It's great weather out here. We're having some beers on the patio. How's your summer going so far?
Yeah, good. Busy. Yeah, really busy. How about yours?
Mine, it's good. It's going good. I'm enjoying finally summer coming. I thought it would never come.
I know. It took its time, but this is like the perfect summer weather where it's not too hot.
Yeah.
It's a little cool. You're not walking around sweating. It's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, love it.
So you're going to have to excuse the fact that we've already been talking for quite a bit of time, talking everything from comic books to wrestling to what we do for work. So we're going to have to rehash a couple of things we talked about, Sean.
Oh, yeah.
It was good material.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So the way I like to get it started, like most podcasts, I want to take it back to the beginning and give us kind of your superhero origin. Where did you grow up and what were the kind of things you were into growing up?
So I grew up basically at the border of Scarborough, Markham.
Okay.
Warden and Steeles. And I didn't grow up with comics like a lot of people who I know did. Being a Canadian kid in the 90s, comics weren't cheap. You would find issues were $5 regularly.
And they're still not cheap.
Yeah, they're still not cheap. I feel like they were even more expensive somehow back in the 90s sometimes. I didn't have a lot of money growing up, so I would never get to read comics. But I would, if I was lucky, I would get the trading cards.
Okay.
So I would collect binders of these cards, each one featuring a different character, usually Marvel stuff.
Okay.
And they would have their stats on the back with their origin stories and stories that the characters were involved in. So that's how I learned about comics and comic book characters.
Yeah.
Was from the trading cards and the encyclopedias, never the comics, though, which is weird.
So you had a thing like superheroes, but you just couldn't afford to read comics.
That's right, yeah. If I was lucky enough to get a comic, I would flip through it and enjoy the artwork. But I mean, I couldn't afford the one before it, and I sure as hell couldn't afford the one after it. So it would just be for fun, looking at the pictures, and that would be it. So I actually didn't grow up with comics the way a lot of people I know did grow up with comics. So it's kind of backwards.
No, you know what? I have a similar story where I would get a random comic book off the spinner rack. My dad would go and buy milk, and his way of kind of like coaxing me to keep him company was like, I'll get you a comic.
Nice.
But I didn't know how to like follow issue for issue. I had no idea of that. And to say to like, hey, we got to go and get the latest issue of such and such, that was never going to happen.
Yeah, that I guess that happened later on.
Exactly. When I was able to buy them myself.
Right.
As it were. So you had the thing for Marvel trading cards and superheroes. What other kind of stuff were you? Were you more of a gaming guy?
If I could, I would, play video games whenever I was either allowed to or when it was affordable to do so.
What was the system that you remember playing with?
Oh, man. I remember my uncle having an NES, and during when I was in kindergarten, I would rush home from school. I lived right beside my house.
Okay.
I would play for 20 minutes and then go back to school after lunch. So I remember growing up with an NES, and then a Super Nintendo as well. I distinctly remember going to Zeller's and getting Donkey Kong Country 2 for Super Nintendo, which was
that was a pretty big game.
It was awesome, yeah. And even to this day, it has probably my second favorite video game soundtrack of all time. David Wise is the composer, and he killed it. It's like I still listen to that soundtrack when I draw.
Really?
On a week-to-week basis. It's so good. So, I grew up with mostly video games as my form of entertainment, which I'm very thankful for because it's such a good medium to use to learn, right?
Yeah.
A lot of, you know, people might argue that, but I found that I got to the point when I was young where I was using video games to actually kind of just learn, like, hand-eye coordination was,
sure.
You know, I owe that to video games, I would have to say.
So, on our podcast, myself, in the Cave of Solitude and the Fastball Special, we have a thing of doing a lot of top fives. Yeah. It's kind of like our go-to.
Cool. Love it.
So, for video games, if you could go back, I guess when you were young, what were your top five video games of your childhood that you remember?
So, Pokemon was huge.
Okay.
When I was in grade 8, and I'm excited for the new Nintendo Switch Pokemon title that was recently announced. Super pumped for that. So Pokemon, Donkey Kong Country, I remember staying up, I was maybe 12 years old, and I stayed up with my uncle until about 4 in the morning, and we played the game from front to back and beat it.
Was there a close age between you and your uncle?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, he was much older.
He was just cool.
Yeah, he was awesome. I owe him so much, and I wish I could tell him that, but we grew up with Donkey Kong, Pokemon, Sonic 2 was a huge game.
Yeah.
Yeah. Super Mario Brothers 3. I remember actually, I think I might have been in like third or fourth grade, and I remember competing at my grade school library for the top score in that game.
Really?
For some reason, yeah. I think Scholastic. Do you remember Scholastic
yeah.
on the book fair people?
Yeah, yeah.
They sponsored an event at our library where you would show up on a Saturday, you get 5 minutes to see the high score that you could possibly get, and then you win a book for, and I got the Super Mario Brothers 3 like player's handbook.
I had that.
Yeah.
Was it a Nintendo Power
yeah,
one?
Yeah.
That thing was great.
It was awesome. It was so nifty.
Yeah, it showed you the one thing I loved about that was, one, it showed you all the secret spots to go to.
Yeah.
But then the memory flip card game.
Yeah.
It showed you where all of them
yeah,
were.
Exactly. Yeah. You never had to guess when you had that book with you.
Yeah.
It was awesome. So definitely Mario 3, Pokemon Sonic 2, Donkey Kong 2. And maybe Ocarina of Time.
Yeah.
We were talking about that earlier. And I remember it was 98 when that game came out, I think. And it was everywhere. It was on the news. It was in newspapers. Like, everywhere was covering this game because it was such a big deal at the time. And I remember I'd never played a Zelda game before then. And my grandmother came up to me and she said, "Shawnee, have you heard of this new Legend of Zelda game that's all over the news and stuff?" I said, "No, I don't know what that's about." And she ended up getting it for the gold edition, the one that came. It was beautiful.
Yeah.
She got that for me for Christmas, and that expanded like everything I know about video games. I'd never, like, that game was such a challenge back in the day for a, you know, 13, 14 year old. It was insane.
I played that as a 30-year-old. Like, I was like 28, 29 on the Nintendo 3DS because I heard, like, this is the greatest game we ever made. So I finally played it because I was saying to you before, I used to play video games more for, like, the sports, the wrestling, the hockey games.
Right.
So I tried this Ocarina of Time, and it was so challenging. I'm thinking to myself, how did kids play this game back then? I tell guys at work, if you're going to get your kid a game, get them this, because it's problem solving, it's very challenging, but you really have to use your senses to play it.
Yeah, very much so.
How did you figure it out, like, playing that game?
Oh, it took me maybe a year to beat, if that's, you know, like, I really put my time in it. I think that was one of the first video games where I played, like, long term, where, you know, I didn't sit down and play it on weekends, like, whenever I had the chance. I would come home from school, flip that on, I was in Hyrule, you know, for like a year. The Water Temple still gives me nightmares, as I'm sure it does many other people out there. and, you know, they actually made that easier on the 3DS version.
Really?
They changed it for the 3DS version, and in the N64 version, they changed it because it was too hard. Like, it was just a nightmare, and I'm glad they did change it too.
How many controllers did you break?
Oh, I can't tell you. I'm too embarrassed to tell you. You know, we broke a lot of controllers in like Mario Party and Mario Kart as well, because you get so frustrated in those games. I mean, they're so much fun.
Like, yeah.
You know, they actually just announced a new Mario Party today.
Oh, really?
For the Nintendo Switch, which looks amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But hopefully I don't break any of those controllers.
Do you still break controllers today?
I don't at all. Okay. Thank God.
Yeah, I think looking back, I don't think there was ever as significant a jump in gaming as you went from like Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis to Nintendo 64.
It was huge, man. It made 3D games the norm. Mm-hmm. You know, you would get, you know, pseudo 3D games on 64 if the developers were creative enough. But there was nothing like Mario 64, where a fully immersive 3D world with such vibrant colors, you know, you never saw that before. And like, I think that's why Ocarina of Time was such a big deal. Because it's like, this has never been done before.
Yeah.
This is, like, the scope of this game at the time was...
It still holds up, though.
It still holds up. I still have that for 3DS, and I'll fire it up once in a while. And... it's still an amazing game.
I made it to the last level and I never finished it.
You never finished it, no?
I played it so much where when I finally got to that castle, I'm just like, okay, I just need to take a break. And I never got around to finishing it. Maybe because I didn't want it to end or
something. For sure, yeah, probably.
It was a ton of fun.
Yeah.
I used a lot of cheats.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I looked up, like, online, like, what do you do in this water temple? I can't lie.
No, you know what? I think I remember, like, in 1998, when the internet was really kind of coming into prominence in homes and stuff like that. I mean, commercial internet anyways. I remember having to look up certain things as well for like certain games. You know, it's just, especially Pokemon, I think. I think we had just gotten our internet connection when Pokemon came out. And I just wanted to know everything about it. I wanted to know all 151. I remember having a notebook. We didn't have a printer, we just had the computer. So I would jot everything down in my notebook, like just reading it off web pages and write everything down instead
Earned
of like printing
it out. The old fashioned way.
Totally, yeah. Instead of printing it out. I don't miss that at all.
Yeah. You know what? There's something to be said about like our generation. I say this a lot, and I'm starting to sound like that old guy, but we kind of got to see the end of the initial turntable era. We saw that in our homes.
Yeah.
To tapes, to CDs, to DVDs. Like we got to see that transition.
Yeah.
And there's a certain investment we had to make when we really liked something to go out and get it. Or like you said with the Pokemon, you had to write it down.
Right.
Because it just wasn't, we didn't all have printers.
For sure.
Yeah. So that attachment that we have to the things of our childhood are a little bit different than today. People are just like, yeah, I found a new artist. Like, no, you didn't.
Right.
You just YouTubed it.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, you know, it's, I understand where you're coming from. And it's kind of the same way with anything tangible as well.
Where
it's just like, you know, a lot of people don't go out to get stuff anymore. Like, you order it off Amazon or...
Yeah, well, I'm guilty. Yeah.
For sure, yeah. You know, it's just... That's just the way it is now. That's, you know?
Yeah.
I don't hate it. Like, I kind of like...
There's convenience.
the convenience to it. It's different now. I think for the better, for the most part. For the most part, yeah. Right. Not for everything.
Okay. So... You were following the superhero backgrounds of characters from the Marvel cards,
right?
The video games. When did you realize that you had a passion for drawing?
Like 5-6 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
Yes. So was it something that you did like growing up that you just had a knack for, or did you just...
You know, if I had a pencil and a sheet of paper, I would doodle. Like, you know, just nothing in particular.
Like a sketchbook or nothing?
No. It was, I think, 2008. I had just read Louis Riel's or sorry, Chester Brown's Louis Riel.
Okay.
Great book. And that was my first exposure to comics. And that was when I realized that comics weren't just like superheroes, and capes and stuff like that. It was,
you know, How many years ago was this?
This was 2008.
Okay.
So 10 years ago. And I realized that, you know, that this is a legitimate form of literature that is for everybody. This isn't just for kids. And then I went on to Watchmen, which is the next logical step for, you know, you want to get into comics. And then that just exploded to every Image title I could get my hands on. At this point, I was working a real job, so right, I could actually buy comics, which was nice.
And what was the shop that you went to?
The
comic shop. What was your comic shop at the time?
It was Comics and More on the Danforth.
Okay.
Awesome shop. It had been in existence in some name or another for like 20 years, same owner. It was so good. So I would go there every Wednesday, pick stuff up. And then it got to the point where in like 2011-ish, I had, you know, reading is fun and I, you know, hopefully be reading for the rest of my life. But I started to want to make and create books after reading so many of them. And then I was gifted an art set in 2012 for my birthday. And I was like, yeah, you know what? I'm going to use this.
What made someone gift you that?
Just because I was reading so many comics.
So they knew that you were...
Yeah, it's just like, oh, you like comics? You must like artwork? Here's some art stuff.
Who got you that?
It was my partner at the time. She just... Good choice on her behalf, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like, who would have thought, right?
Yeah, I'm really happy that she did that. And from there, it just kind of... I bought books right from DMV, right down the street.
Right.
I would, every paycheck, I would go spend a few bucks on used art books and just start learning. You know, that was, to me, the most logical way. I couldn't go to school. I had already gone to school for music at this time. I couldn't really drop everything and go again. So, I mean, I guess I could have, but...
That's incredible.
Know. Yeah, I mean... It's kind of the old school way, I guess, where it's just like, I'm going to just learn how to do this now because I want to do it.
But you know what? That's very inspiring because a lot of people think by the time maybe they're in their 20s or they already have a job or they've already gone to school, it's like, this isn't the time for me to just take up a new skill set, like becoming an artist.
Right, right.
Usually people feel like they've found their calling, like, well, I always drew since I was, you know, 6 or 7. That's what I did.
Yeah.
So for you to get an art set and just be like, I'm going to do it, that's incredible.
Well, I don't know. I feel like it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy where people are like, well, it's been 30 years. You can't just drop this and learn how to do that. Like, it's never out of the question for anybody. It doesn't matter what your age
not.
Is. You know?
Definitely not.
I mean, you see news reports from people graduating from high school and college in their 60s.
Right.
No, it's like, it's the same thing. It's like, if you want to do something and you really want to do it and you have the drive to do it, then there's no reason you can't.
Yeah, definitely. Well, living proof right here. That's what I mean by inspirational. You make people realize, like, wait a second, you can do it. Mm-hmm. Even though you said, you know, you would doodle,
yeah.
But just because you loved comic books, you said, I'm going to learn to draw.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I'm going to put a pin in that just for a second because you said that you went to school for music.
Yeah.
So what brought you to going to school for that?
I was in bands growing up, like 16, 17. And to me, it just made sense. Like, oh, I'm in a band.
What did you play?
Bass player.
Okay.
Yeah. My brother was a drummer.
Okay.
And so we, you know, instantly got along pretty well.
What was the name of the band?
Free the Future. It was named after Dragon Ball Z episode.
I like the name of the band.
Yeah.
It's an old name.
Yeah.
What kind of music?
Like punk rock music. You know, we grew up in the 90s when, like, skate punk reached... Yeah, you know, Zenith, and just it was untouchable and just like the shit. And then we decided we wanted to do that, And I thought we were a pretty decent band back in the day. You know, we had a lot of fun. Like, it didn't even matter.
That's what matters.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we had a blast, but... I thought that, you know, if I'm in a band right now, then I have to do music for the rest of my life, because this is...
your calling. You
know, yeah, exactly, yeah. So I went to school for engineering and post-production, and I did that for almost 5 years after I graduated. I got an internship at a studio in the West End, worked there for a little while, and then decided that the music industry wasn't for me. So I took off from that.
What was it about the music industry that you didn't like? We hear stories all the time.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
What's your experience?
Well, this is going to make me sound like a, you know, 80-year-old man, but it was the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Like, each one of those things is perfectly fine, you know, but when you... it's just...
when it's abused.
Yeah, there was an excess of that in the business, and... it just seemed like everybody that I was working with was more focused on becoming a rock star than creating music, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, everyone wanted... They, you know, before they reached celebrity status, they acted like they were celebrities. And, you know, not as to, you know, put anyone down, but it just... it became not a fun place to work.
Do you think it has anything to do with... people who are maybe abstract thinkers or artistically minded, because they're creating, they develop somewhat of a ego, because they're like, I'm more creative, I'm of a higher mind being in this, I don't know how to put it into words. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. yes and no. I think that it actually... because, like, a lot of the people that I work with, there was a handful who were amazing talents.
Mm-hmm.
So incredibly talented and down to earth and easy to work with. And just very awesome, smart people. Then there were the few who were equally as talented, but they weren't treating it like work. And if you're, you know, it's so easy to get into the studio, have a few drinks, smoke a few this, do a few that, and forget why you're there. You know, it's almost more about the experience of being in a studio and doing all this shit, that it really took away from the art of making music.
Right.
Because you would be working with people who didn't even know where the hell the microphone was, and it was 3 feet away from them, you know?
Oh.
It just became... like working at a daycare. And
so you almost felt like it was almost disrespectful to making of the music.
You know what? It was disrespectful to that and disrespectful to themselves.
Right.
And I didn't want to work with people like that. And I just noticed that there was a lot of that. And I don't know if it was the neighborhood or the, you know, the area that we worked in or just the scene itself. But I got sick of it and decided to move on. And I love making music. I still make music every week. I'm doing something musical, either on my own or with somebody else. But I couldn't do it professionally with the people that I was working with. So I got out.
How old are you when you were, from the time you started to the time you set up?
That was from about 22 to 26. Yeah.
That's pretty mature, though, for you to be able to be working in the industry you want to work in and say, you know what, this lifestyle, I'm seeing it now, this isn't for me.
Well, you know, the guy who taught me, like, the guy who ran the studio and who owned it, he was of the very specific mindset that your 20s and early 30s, you spend working. If you want to party, do that, you know, 35 to whoever cares the rest of your life. But if you spend your 20s and early 30s working and really putting the time in and the effort, you're only going to be able to party more in your late 30s.
Create a legacy that you can kind of rest your laurels on, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. You know, something to get you started, because it doesn't just happen overnight. It doesn't happen in a month. It doesn't happen in a year. If you're lucky, it's like winning the lottery if it does.
True, right? Yeah.
You know, you put the work in while everyone else is partying, and then you can spend, you know, not that you want to, but if you do, you can spend your later life having fun and relaxing while everyone else is working.
You've kind of earned it.
For sure.
Yes, you could say, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Put the work in.
Yeah.
So what do you do musically now? You say that you still create musically.
Yeah, so I score for independent game developers. Like, I just scored a game called Super Blood Hockey, which is on Steam right now. It's been getting awesome reviews, which is very heartwarming.
Yeah.
I'm very happy to hear that. I'm scoring another game right now that's still in development.
So what platforms are these games on?
Well, mostly Steam. Like, if I've done something, you're going to find it on Steam, probably. I know that one of the games that I'm working on is being ported to the Nintendo Switch, which is crazy. Like, for me, that's a dream come true.
Yeah.
Growing up with video games,
yeah,
and being a fan of the Switch.
And being a fan of video game scores.
Exactly, yes.
Now you're making them.
Yeah, it's really neat.
How do you go in, like, the process of scoring a video game, how do you get to that? Like, what is the... You watch a movie and you can kind of feel the emotion, I guess, of a movie.
Right, yes.
So what goes into scoring a video game?
It really depends on how much the developers want to give you. They could say, we need a title theme that, you know, has this type of feeling, this type of ambience, this type of mood, this type of energy. And then I usually like to ask them for references and say, what other games have inspired this one? Where are you, like, what's your creative mindset of when you're approaching this game? Who are you targeting? What's the age demographic? All of this stuff helps. Even if they can't give me a perfect level description, knowing who this is going to and what has influenced the game will give me at least somewhere to start. Something where I can, you know, get my feet wet with it at least. Yeah.
How long does it take you to, from the initial pitch of the developer to you coming up with either a theme or a score? What's the timeline for you?
I like to work fast, as fast as I can, just because we were talking about this earlier, being freelance, you have to get stuff off your plate as quickly as you can to move on to the next thing. So it could take a day, it could take a week. It really depends on what the schedule looks like at the time that the project is accepted.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, but I would make music in my free time anyways for fun, you know, not making any money, just for the hell of it. So I have my own process. I have my own templates, my own instruments that I use. It just makes things easier when you have all that stuff. So the ability to get something done in one day isn't off the table when you're prepared.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So for me, when I hear that, it's more like, where does that inspiration come from? I know you get the information from the developer and what they're looking for, but then you've also got to come up with something original.
Right. You know, I don't have a good answer for you on that one. I can't tell you. I don't even know. I can't speak for every musician, obviously.
Yeah.
But there's always something, like a melody or a rhythm that I've got in my head, something I just want to get out.
Yeah.
Just like, I guess, I'm a writer who just, you know, you could tell the writer, I need 3 pitches for tomorrow. And if they're good at their job, they'll come up with them. Maybe they're not great,
right,
but they're a start.
Okay.
You know, they can be embellished, they can be edited, they can be all that stuff. So coming up with ideas isn't really that challenging. But getting them as close to perfect as you can, that's where the challenge is.
Right, right. I get you. So, you do the video game. What's that, the terminology for it called?
For what? Like the...
The video game scoring.
The video game score?
Like a... Video game scoring, like that. What's the trade name for it?
That's a good question.
Is it... I thought I was on your website. It was like chip...
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah, yeah. Chiptunes. Like, chiptunes is like when you're using like old school 8-bit
okay.
sounds, because all of those...
Is that what the scores you make are, that sound?
Some of them are. Okay. Most of them are, I would say. Actually, if you go on my SoundCloud, that's almost all. That's all.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. But then some of it will be... Like, the game that I'm scoring right now... It's all real instruments, like real guitars, real bass. Drums aren't real, but it's as close to real as I can possibly get it without hiring a drummer.
And how many instruments do you play?
I just play guitar and bass.
Two more than I play.
Right. It's never too late to learn.
Yeah, it's true. Sean Daly's proof.
Yeah. Back in the studio days, I would hire my brother because he plays drums, and he's right. one of the best drummers I've ever heard as well.
Really?
Yes.
Is he still playing a band?
Not in a band, but he'll play casually as his drum gets set up. So much fun to jam with him still.
Isn't it frustrating when you see like the best talent you've ever seen and they're not like the most well-known person?
Yeah, it is. I hope that never stops happening, though. As frustrating as it is.
It's true.
I always want to be seeing people who are topping what I think is the best of the best. And, it's inspirational as well. Right. It's frustrating, but yeah, it's inspirational.
So, again, we're going to do another top five. Mm-hmm. What were your top five favorite punk bands growing up?
This one might be a little easier. Okay. Bad Religion, number one.
Is that the patch?
Yeah,
the bang?
Yeah, okay. That's right, yeah. NOFX. AFI, although their newer stuff is lost on me, and it's not. But their older stuff is amazing. Maybe this is harder. Oh, Misfits.
Okay.
Another one, just classic horror punk. And then, you know, I've always had those top four in my top four of all time, actually.
Right.
And this isn't a punk band, but Rush. Like, you know, they have roots in punk. I mean, you had...
Technically sound, I don't think you find better than that.
Yeah, I mean, I can't disagree with that. They're, you know, Terry Brown, their producer back in the day, just killed it with everything that they did. But, you know, punk has roots in bands like Rush, where Rush was coming along and doing not really heavy metal, but not really progressive. Like, yeah, they were doing progressive, but... They weren't really doing heavy metal. They were kind of doing something a little different, very melodic, very much to do with story. And that influenced a lot of the punk musicians that came up in the mid-70s. And, yeah, big time. So I'm just going to count them anyways, because, you know, punk is a music, it's a sound, but it's also a mentality.
Right,
which
absolutely.
Is do what you want regardless of what people say. And when Rush was coming out with, I think it was their third album, it might have been their fourth, 2112.
Yeah.
Their producer said, like, you can't do these 20-minute songs anymore. People don't like them. They're not radio songs. They're like, if you do this and it fails, you're off. And they said, you know what? We don't give a shit. We're going to do it anyways. And they did it, and it was one of their top albums of all time. And it cemented...
It's one of the top albums.
Yeah. No kidding. Yeah,
right?
For sure.
Not
yeah.
just theirs.
Yeah, everyone knows that. They're, you know, metal, they're progressive rock in the 70s and early 80s. And they did what they wanted. They had the punk mentality. So I'm just going to say that they're, you know, they're in cool. some ways a punk band.
Awesome. Yeah. I like it. I like the Dark Horse pick of Rush and the reasoning behind it,
because sure.
it adds the context to it.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's U-turn again back to the art now and the comic book.
Yeah.
When did you decide that making a comic was something that you were going to pursue?
So that was right before my first fan expo. I can't remember when that was. It might have been 2013. No, it might have been 2014. I'll say 2014. That sounds about right. 16, 17. Yeah. maybe it was 2013. Anyways, I had applied for it, and I was originally just going to... I had been drawing Marvel and DC characters and making prints of them, and originally I was going to show up and sell prints and do that, because I knew from going to conventions that that's what a lot of people did. So I applied for Fan Expo, I got in, and then I realized, like, oh shit, I better have comics. Like, it doesn't make sense to go to a comic convention and you don't have comics.
So, I don't know if everyone thinks that way.
No, I, a lot of people don't, which I learned after the fact.
Yeah.
Yeah, I learned that.
So 2008, you get the art kit.
That was 2012-ish. 2008, I started reading comics.
2008, you started reading comics.
Yeah.
So in 1 year of that, having that art kit, you applied at Fan Expo.
Right, yeah. I just decided that I was just going to... Like, who cares? Like, what's the worst that could happen? I don't get in, right?
Is that the punk mentality?
I guess so. I mean, you know, I did what I wanted to, and it seemed to work out.
That's, like, I know it's hyperbole, but it's incredible. Because a lot of people spend their whole life drawing, and they still don't think they're good enough to be at a, you know what I mean? Like, they don't think their art's good enough.
I get that. I guess I don't know. I try hard not to feel like either what I'm doing isn't good enough or it's not up to state. It's like I'm doing what I want.
No, that's
so
great.
I don't give whatever.
Yeah,
if you don't
like
it, that's awesome. But I like it.
Yeah.
So I don't care.
So how much practice did you put, how much time did you put into drawing?
I was working at the Toronto Star at the time when I was drawing all this stuff. And I had an office there with a door that I could close. Mm-hmm. So I would show up a little bit early, half an hour early. I get all my shit done. I close my door. And I would sit there and draw while I was supposed to be working. Maybe not the best thing to do.
Okay, you got paid for it.
For sure, I got I paid my bills. That was fine. And I got all my work done, which was the
That's
most important
matters.
Thing. Yeah. So I would close my door and I would just draw for like 3 or 4 hours. However I could, just, and I still have all that shit tucked away in sketchbooks and stuff. But that's kind of where I learned how. It was like in the office when I had spread, and then when I would come home, eat dinner, hang out for a little bit, and then just go lock myself in my own room and draw for a little bit.
So you enjoyed it. This was like...
Oh, I loved it. I still love learning. You know, I'll hopefully never be really happy with what I'm doing, because obviously you want to keep learning and keep working and getting better. But especially back then, I only knew that I had one way to go. Like, you know, you can't get worse at drawing when you don't know how to draw, really. You know what
I
mean?
Right. Yes.
So there was really only one thing to do, which was keep practicing and keep learning. And yeah, that's how all that went down.
So you were going there to make prints at the first Fan Expo.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of stuff were you reading at the time? Were you reading? You said you had 10 long boxes before.
Yeah.
So what kind of stuff did you? Were you into the superhero stuff? Or you?
Yeah, I love the superhero stuff.
Okay.
This would have been around the time DC did the New 52. I think 2012 was was the time that they did that, somewhere around there. So I was really that, and you know, hate it all you want. To me, that was a perfect jumping on point.
Yeah, it is a jumping on point.
Yeah, for sure. It was for somebody who was actually very intimidated by issue 600, issue 700.
Of course, I'm still intimidated by that.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, this was very welcome for me. So I was reading almost every title that they had going on. Marvel was easy to read because they had the recap page, they still do,
right
at the front. So you could jump into any book right now.
Yeah.
You read that first page and you're essentially good to go for this arc, at least. So almost every title I could get from Marvel I was reading. And then Image stuff, I don't know if I was quite there yet. I had read a lot of their older stuff, like Why the Last Man.
That was Image or Vertigo?
Oh, shit, that was Vertigo. Sorry. Thank you.
No, it's okay.
I get them all mixed up, so...
If Brian came on, he's got a bunch of Image
That's
books,
right, yeah. Yeah, that was absolutely Vertigo, which I think I was reading few different. Sandman was Vertigo, was that?
I think so, yeah, yeah.
I had bought all the trades around that time as well. So I was reading everything that I could get. Like, you name it, I might have been reading it. That's dropped off significantly now. But at
it
the
catches
time,
up to you.
It does, it does. It
I tried that.
Yeah.
Trying to read as much as I could, and before you know, you're like, oh my gosh.
It's hard, man.
Yeah, it's
things
very
get
hard.
Confusing. You're like mixing stories together.
Yeah, what you read.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But yeah, I was trying to read as much as I could at the time that I was learning how to draw. Obviously, because art books are great. They'll get you the fundamentals of what you need to know, but stylistically, I feel that where you develop is by looking at what other people are doing and absorbing the decisions that they're making and asking yourself questions on why they did this, why they laid this out like that, why is their line weight like this, why did the colors change like that. And you really only get that by reading comics. If you don't have time to read, good luck, you know, finding your own style, I guess.
So, who were the artists during that era of you taking in all of this information, this content, that were the ones that stood out to you?
Ryan Stegman. His Spider-Man stuff.
Yeah, I love Ryan Stegman.
Killer, absolutely. And for what it's worth, one of the nicest dudes I've ever met in comics.
Yeah.
Super awesome. Guys like Jeff Lemire and Matt Kent,
yep,
who kind of, they had this very tangible style where you can tell that this wasn't digital work.
Yep.
This was a piece of paper and some ink and some brushes, and it was very visceral and just pure story-driven art.
I almost feel like, I hate pairing people, but I almost feel like if you like Matt Kent, you're going to like Jeff Lemire.
Yeah, that's a totally fair thing to do.
Whether it's their art or their writing style, they're great. I love
Very,
both those guys.
Just amazing, yeah. Those two huge influences. Those were like the big three, I think, when I was first learning to draw.
Good big three.
Yeah.
So you got Matt Kent, Jeff Lemire. What was the third one? I already forgot.
Ryan Stegman.
Ryan Stegman.
Yeah.
Of course. Spider-Man.
Yes.
Love to get him on the show. He's a super nice guy.
Awesome.
He was one of the guys I met at Fan Expo where I was at his table talking to him. And I always feel like with the big pros, they got so much traffic that you feel like you're bugging them.
Yeah.
When he was talking to me, he was showing me stuff from the Renew Your Vows that wasn't out yet. And I was like, okay, I'll talk to you later. He's like, oh, you're leaving? he was welcoming conversation, just a super nice
Very
guy.
Welcoming
yeah.
guy. You
Great
know,
guy.
That's I wish everyone in comics was as cool and as nice as he is.
Yeah.
Not that a lot of people aren't. Almost everyone I've met in comics is like a really down-to-earth, really cool, chill person.
Yeah.
You know? It's a great industry.
Out.
He does.
Stands out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you got those guys that you're really looking at, their style. It's unique, especially Matt Kent and Jeff Lemire, where, again, it's that sort of thing of they're just doing what they feel they got to do.
Yeah.
So where did your art style... How did you end up on... It's very signature. You can tell it's you right away.
Cool.
So where did you kind of, say, settle on that? Or did it just happen organically?
It just happened the way it happened. It wasn't... You know, the choice to me was in the tools.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is the type of brush that I'm going to use, the type of ink that I'm going to use, the type of pens that I'm going to use, and the type of feeling that I'm going to approach the stories with. But mostly the tools. Like, to me, using like a crow quill pen, which is one of those nibs, and a certain type of brush, just got me everything that I wanted out of the look that I was going for, which is obviously based on some of the artists that I was reading at the time. But it really happens kind of, I hate to use the word organically because you can use that for anything, but that's the way that it happened. And it wasn't until Samurai Grandpa that I had I was told, anyways, that like, oh, this is a recognizable style in a way. I didn't see it. You know, just when you draw pages the way you draw them, you don't really... I can't say that you don't really see it. Like, a lot of artists will purposely try. Like, they'll have a style in their head. They'll sit down and they'll draw until they are able to create what they see in their head. But sometimes it just happens through trial and error, by accident, almost. And I feel like that's the way that I started drawing the way that I draw.
Was, you know, I see having it in your head.
For sure, yeah. I knew the tools that I wanted to use. I knew the medium I wanted to work in, and the rest was just taking ideas and cues from the other artists that I was influenced by. Like, you know, if I'm going to draw an eye, how am I going to draw it? It's got to look the same most of the time that I draw it, or else it's going to look inconsistent, and it's not going to be able to be, you know, known that it was me who drew it, kind of thing.
Right.
Akira Toriyama, have you heard of him at all? Dragon Ball.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people who I know say, like, oh, Dragon Ball, I love the show. If anyone of you say that, read the books. Read the comics. Because his style is just one of the best I've ever seen in my life. And I took a lot of cues from him as well when developing a style.
Yeah. So were you into Japanese like manga and anime and that kind of stuff?
A little, here and there. Not too much. Not as much as maybe other people were. Definitely Dragon Ball. I actually did end up reading a lot of manga while I was reading superhero stuff like Death Note. I was reading Planets was another one. And then I was studying like Astro Boy stuff as well, because that was such a big deal. That it's still like classic, timeless work as well.
Right.
So yeah, a little bit here and there. But their style of storytelling is so different than what we have in the West.
Right.
That it felt wrong not to try to learn from it.
Yeah.
You know?
So you are taking in all these influences, you're developing a style of art, you're ready to go to Fan Expo, but you say, I don't got my own comic book, so what am I going to do there? What did you do next?
I decided that, you know, it seemed like a bad idea to just jump into... Well, first I had to teach myself how to write, because writing is, or drawing is only half of a comic. You got to figure out the story and pacing and characters and dialogue and all that stuff. So I bought writing books, and then I just started doing the same thing, where I would be studying the comics that I was reading, asking why the writers made this decision, why they chose this panel right after this one, why they ended the page on that panel.
Really deconstruct it.
Exactly. Yeah, you have to if you're going to learn. And from there, I just tried to teach myself as much as possible. And then I started with short stories, because I decided that a long-form story just wasn't really plausible with the amount of time that I had leading into Fan Expo. It just made sense to do shorts, which is where Terraquil came from. So the first comics that I did were those Terraquil mini comics that I just self-printed and stapled and gave out for free.
Tell me about Terraquil, because I've read the Bridge Builders Creed,
right?
The two shorts, but you never had a copy of Terraquil.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. So give us the synopsis of what Terraquil was.
So it was just experiments in writing and drawing, where each one was a short story. Some of them had dialogue, some of them didn't. Just set in this weird province called Terraquil, which is very influenced by Dr. Seuss, with weird, wacky creatures.
Okay. I was going to ask, where did that come from?
Like Dr. Seuss was a huge influence. I grew up with his books, which you don't really think about, but they're almost comics.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
Sure.
His work was very influential, so I wanted to create just the world. You know, I had always, from playing video games back in the day, you know, you, when you're, like, the games that I grew up with, like Super Mario Brothers, those all take place in their own weird, wacky worlds,
right,
with their own rules and their own strange things about them. And I always wanted to do that growing up, so I figured this was a good opportunity to try that. And that's really where it came from. It was just, I want to make a weird world with strange creatures, but also rooted in reality with stories that people could relate to,
yes,
maybe on a personal level or through somebody else that they know. And it was just kind of a mix of the weird, wacky Seuss and the down-to-earth reality of everyday life.
Right.
Yeah.
So when I'm reading the Bridge Builder's Creed, I'm actually really impressed. You've got good storytelling in the panels. With the writing, I go back and I reread the captions of what Yoel is saying to himself. And I'm really impressed with the writing of it.
Not to say
that I didn't think you were a good writer, but there's things in there that I feel there's depth to what you're, more to the story than just a wacky world, if you will.
No.
Where does that come from? What's the subtext of what's the land that the Terraquil,
yeah,
right?
Right.
But Yodel, these stories take place after the story of Terraquil.
Yes, I mean, yeah, absolutely. Or maybe before.
Okay. Yeah. So there's some sort of a, depending on how you look at it, a continuity.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
But there's a lot of subtext to what is being said in regard to interaction, communication, and building bridges,
right,
for each other. Where did that come from for you?
Well, a lot of the books that I had been reading when I came up with the idea were about people with, actually, I'll use The Underwater Welder, Jeff Lemire's book,
okay,
as an example. He took a job, which is a welder, and gave this character a fantastical journey, and a really intimate look at their life. But really, at the end of the day, they're just a welder. Just a person with a regular job like anybody else. So I decided that I kind of wanted to create a character who had a job that existed somewhere in the real world, something that somebody else out there does for a living, but give it a fantastical twist. And the idea of a bridge just really hit home for me, because, I mean, symbolically, you could come up with a million different reasons of what a bridge means as opposed to what it actually is.
Right.
But at the same time, just something somebody makes with their hands that gets you from point A to point B. Like, there's so many practical uses to a bridge.
It's very metaphorical, though, the way you talk about it.
It should be. It should be. If it's just a bridge that you walk across, it's not that interesting.
Yeah.
But as soon as it becomes, something that you have to think more closely about,
yeah,
it's more fun, I think, for the reader.
And that's what impressed me about Bridge Builder's Creed, because I'm reading the mini comic of it, and I feel like I'm missing out on something because I haven't read Terraquil, but you clearly say in the synopsis at the back, like, if you've read it, good. If you haven't, it's okay. You'll still manage.
Right.
So I'm reading it, and I'm like, is this about bridge building? Like, I don't get it. But as I go through it, I'm like, this is wonderful.
Cool. Thank you.
And then when I read the second part where Yodel is going, he's left his main town to go and try to fix other bridges that have been destroyed, yep, by the war. He has that little monologue with himself talking about the way we used to build the bridges, the team used to build the bridges. People would say, in order for us to have done it, we had to have stayed up all night. But really, we were staying up at weeks at a time.
And, right,
you know, going past the level of what humans are supposed to be able to do, but they chalked it up to us taking some sort of a drug.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, it's impossible for men and women to just do it on their own, right? Like,
right,
where did that come from for you?
I think that probably came from working at the studio. okay. the recording studio, because the schedule that we had there was not, you know, you could maybe have to start a shift at 6 in the morning, finish it by 3 p.m., and then start a shift at 4 p.m., to 11 p.m. and then there's the night crowd that comes in from like midnight till 5 in the morning. You're men, like if you get an hour of sleep, if you get like 3 hours of sleep over the course of 24 hours, like you're doing all right. So it was kind of that mentality where, if, you know, there are some jobs where you just have to give it everything you have. There's very little rest involved, and you know, just deal with it. And anyone who says that you can't probably just isn't capable of it or doesn't want to, kind of thing. And I'm not saying that you should do that. Like, treat your body well.
Right.
Get the rest that you need and take care of yourself. But, you know, sometimes you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah, no, I like that little commentary because you could take it in different ways where we always feel that people's successes or accomplishments, we always try to excuse it or say there's a cheat code involved in
for
what
sure.
they did.
Yeah.
We never like to give ourselves the credit for what we can accomplish.
Absolutely,
ourselves.
Yeah. That's said it perfectly. That's very much what I was going for.
Okay, so I'm reading you correctly.
Yes, absolutely.
So, you know, I have to say, between your storytelling and the panels, because in Samurai Grandpa, you didn't write that one.
That's right.
But when I read the stuff that you did write, I was like, we've got a real talent on our hands, because you could, if you weren't just drawing, you could write your own story with someone else drawing your stuff, it would still be just as good. So that's another feather in the cap.
That's
for you.
That's, to be honest, that's the goal. Somewhere down the line is to start writing more than I'm drawing. Right now, I'm just having so much fun drawing that I don't want to stop. So, you know, maybe one day down the line, but it's nice to hear that it's not impossible based on
it's definitely, you're not, doesn't come across as a person who's like, oh, I wrote a comic, check it out, it's so good, because you got a ton of those people at these shows,
right?
And it's so hard to, everybody loves comics at a con or a TCAF or what the case may be, and everybody's making a comic,
right?
And the nice thing about what you're putting out there is, like, it's a quality hardcover book, in the case of Samurai Grandpa, where you pick it up and you feel like you've got something real, tangible, instead of just, you know, someone's little mini comic for $3, and it's sometimes just shapes.
Right.
It's like, look at my great story. It's like, it's clever.
For sure, yeah. There's, you know,
you're not a hack.
Thank you.
You really got talent.
Yeah. There's, you know, I love finding weird, abstract zines and minis at conventions, but at the end of the day, I'm usually looking for a story that I can relate to that's going to touch me.
Right.
And really make me ask questions.
Exactly.
You know? So, yeah, I mean, nothing against anybody who...
No, absolutely not.
...wants to make abstract, stitched-together, you know,
sure.
zines and stuff. That's awesome. But yeah, like you said, everybody's making comics. Like, everybody. It's... I mean, I wish, to be honest, I wish more people at, like, Fan Expo and Comic-Con were making more comics. Because those are very much... That's a print society where it's walls and walls of prints. Again, nothing against that. That's fine. But, I mean, you're at a comic convention. Comics are good.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you want... And it's nice to see, like... people such as yourself, or even like Ricky and Shane, who I'm obviously friends with, but you go to their table, it's like they've got something tangible, a book you can hold, and it's nice, you know, and
yeah,
you see that the quality is invested in it.
Yeah,
good.
Absolutely. And, you know, shout out to Ricky and Shane. Those are two of, you know, among quite a few, two of my favorite people in the local scene right now. Like,
they're all right.
Nah, they're fine. Yeah, no, no, they're
screw those guys.
Oh, I hope they're not listening.
Shane's listening.
Yeah.
The thing, Shane's become my Sean Daly. what you are to Jay Clark, that's what Shane's become to my podcast.
Shout out to Clark as well. He's a super talented guy.
He's the first person who I heard your name on every episode that he records. He always talks about Sean Daly. I'm like, who is this guy?
I honestly, like, I couldn't have done it without him. As sappy as that sounds, he's been such a stand-up supporter for such a long time. I remember back when I first started, he asked me to talk with him on a show, which had just been getting started at the time, and we wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't for him. So, like, big thanks to Jay.
Yeah, shout out to Jay. Yeah. So, Samurai Grandpa, how did that come together? You went from doing your own book, drawing and writing, just so you could have something to show at Fan Expo, but now you're being hired.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
How did that come together?
So I had actually been hired for quite a few books before then,
awesome.
Which I've written and, or sorry, not written, but which I've drawn that have just never seen the light of day. One of them actually is just getting ready to go to print, which is exciting.
But you got paid for them.
I did. Yes, I did. It was an actual job. But Samurai Grandpa was the book where, when the writer pitched it to me, writer Easton Taverna, shout out to him, awesome guy. He just said, you know, I like your work. I'd like to work with you at some point in time. I have a story that I'm writing called Samurai Grandpa. And as soon as he said that, I'm like, yep. That, like, don't say anything else. Samurai Grandpa is amazing. Like, just the name of it, like, you've got me, man. And from there, he sent me the script. We did a paid test where he had me do the first chapter, I think 22, 23 pages. We loved working together. We had a great, you know, we hit it off from the start. And then a little while later, we did a Kickstarter to raise the rest of the funds, which we did. We exceeded our goals. We hit our stretches. And then that was it. We started immediately after, which was amazing. And that was such a fun book to work on.
Yeah, it seems like it. When I flipped through that book, it seems like it was fun.
It was. It was so much fun. Easton gave me all the freedom that I wanted. If I said, oh, we should change this dialogue to this, or we should replace this page with this one, or we should try this out, he was always like, yep, go ahead. Just do it. Have fun with it. I trust you. And then anytime he said, you know, oh, your artwork could use this, you should... Whenever he said, your artwork could use this, you should try that, you should try this other thing, it was like, yeah, absolutely. Like, let's give it a shot. Let's try it. So he was, you know...
Easy collaboration.
So easy. Just so much fun. He actually just sent me a script for a short that we're doing, like a Samurai Grandpa short.
Okay.
He sent that to me this week, so we're getting back into it.
So, the color palette that you chose for Samurai Grandpa, how do you settle on something like that?
I don't know that I settled on it or if it happened by accident.
Okay.
I mean, I must have settled on it eventually.
Settled is, sounds like a...
Yeah, let it...
Not settled, but you decided.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I don't know that it's something I did decide. I think while I was working on it, I was just experimenting until I found something that I said, oh, yeah, I like it. This is good. Like, I like this. And then that was it. I just passed it by Easton. He said, yeah, this looks fine. And then we were just like, yeah, all right, on to the next thing.
That's so funny. Like, I'm reading it thinking to myself that there's a very purposeful... because there's a warmth to it, and it kind of lends itself to the setting and the scenery.
Right.
Without it, it doesn't put it in any sort of specific time frame. It's just like it exists at some point in time.
Right, right.
Yeah, so it works. But
that's good. That's good to hear.
Yeah. That's the thing. Like, I'm wondering when you guys do that, is there like, we got to make it feel like this or...
You know what? Sometimes, in fact, I'd wager most of the time, there's a very purposeful choice for choosing a color palette. You look at a book like Deathly Class, if you, you know, that's a book that takes place in the 80s.
Yes.
So, of course, it's going to be vibrant and fluorescent and very loud.
Right.
You know, and, you know, we might have subconsciously looked at Samurai Gramp and said, oh, well, this is almost a period piece, so it should be a little toned down and maybe not as vibrant or as bright as something like Deadly Class. But there was really no conscious decision moving into that. It was just, oh, this looks good. let's roll with that.
It worked out well.
Cool, thank you.
So where can people, if people wanted to get Terraquill or Samurai Grandpa, where could they get and buy your stuff?
So we have an Etsy for Samurai Grandpa, or if you just visit Etsy and type that in, you'll find it pretty easily. Something, if you want Terraquill, it's being reprinted later this summer by Source Point Press. I will make sure you get one. They'll be reprinted potentially with a new cover and additional content. But that's being released by Source Point Press, who's an American publisher that's really starting to make waves. I'm drawing another book for them right now, and they've been so much fun to work with, because they really remind me of the punk movement from the 80s and 90s.
Right.
Which is very much DIY.
Right,
like, just have fun. Do what you want. We're going to get behind it 100% as long as it's quality material. And just do something different. Do something fun. Enjoy it. So Source Point will be publishing, republishing Terraquill. And I'll make sure you get one.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. So, when I do this, when I do episodes sometimes with my wife, I do this thing where I call it random thoughts. I ask her some random questions, and I get her natural reaction or thing. So I want to do a couple of those with you.
I love it, yeah.
Okay. So these are generic questions. I didn't come up with all of them. I found a bunch of them on the internet, so I can't take credit. So, good question to ask. Who is a better cook, your mother or your grandmother?
My mother.
Your mother?
Yeah, that's fairly easy to say.
What's your favorite dish that she makes?
Beef stew. Yeah, she makes a killer beef stew.
That's the comfort food.
Yep, that's awesome. I haven't had it in a while, but if I could have it every day for the rest of my life, I would.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mama gets the win.
Yeah.
What book do you wish would be turned into a movie?
Oh, that's a good one. Does it have to be a comic, or is it like
anything you
book?
Want?
Anything I want?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to cheat on this one. I'm going to say The Dark Tower, which was made into a movie, but book four, The Dark Tower, which is a standalone kind of prequel to the entire series.
Okay.
But it's my favorite book in the series, and I think it would make an amazing movie.
So book four, I've never read The Dark Tower, but everyone who talks about it, it's like the end all be all.
Yeah, I mean, it's Stephen King's opus. It's, you know, he spent over 20 years creating the book, so it's not for everybody, but it's awesome. And make sure you read it.
Dark Tower. So did you like the movie?
I didn't see it because I knew what to expect.
Yeah.
And I, as soon as it was out, I read the reviews. I got reviews from people I love and trust, and no good.
No good.
Yeah.
Gotcha. All right. So what are some songs that you know by heart? What's your guilty pleasure song that you sing?
Oh, guilty pleasure. I like a lot of Heart. Like the, you know, band from the 70s, 80s, 90s, Heart. Their songs are fantastic. Yeah, I'd say Alone by Heart. That's the song, yeah.
That's the song, yeah.
Oh, such a good song. So good.
If you could rename the street that you grew up on, what would you rename it?
The street I grew up on was named Bamberg. I'm just going to say Hamburg.
Hamburg?
Because we had
Why
a McDonald's
not?
There, and their hamburgers are good, so Hamburg.
Not the Sean Daly Boulevard.
Probably not. Yeah, I don't think anyone needs to live there.
What animal would you say best represents your personality?
A chameleon.
A chameleon?
Yeah.
I'd have to agree with that.
Cool.
Because I don't know what... You're a musician, you're a writer, you're a comic artist. You just, like, you work for the web design.
Right, yeah. There's a few hats in there, a few colors, I guess you could say.
That's right.
Yeah, definitely chameleon.
Okay, here's a fun question. What piece of clothing or accessory can someone wear that immediately makes you have a bad opinion about them?
Oh, man. That's a hard one.
It is a hard one.
I'm going to say, and, you know, hate me if you, a Trump shirt is going to make me have a bad opinion.
A MAGA hat. I call it the Make America Great Again.
Yeah. MAGA hat. There you go, yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people don't like Kanye West just for that right now. Okay. Who in the movie business seems the most down to earth?
Oh, man. Ryan Reynolds, I would have to say. Just, he seems like a really chill guy.
He's a comic book fan.
For sure, yeah, exactly.
That's why.
And he does, as far as I know, he does a decent amount of charity work. He seems like a really nice guy.
Yeah, that's a good pick. I'd agree with that.
Cool.
Good Canadian boy, too.
Yeah, that's right.
This one could be fun. What's your favorite sounding word?
Oh, see, that's so... Just being in sound for such a long time, that's a really hard one, because a lot of the times I'll hear a word and just think it's one of the funniest things I've ever heard, and I'll just sit there repeating it over and over again out loud, laughing at it, which sounds like I'm insane, but, you know, it's like language is funny, I guess. Mumbo, I guess.
Mumbo?
Mumbo. That's a funny word, mumbo.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. Is there a word in the English language you just can't stand? Like, when people say, some people, I've been told, the word moist makes them feel gross.
No, that doesn't do anything for me.
So is there something for you that you just, like, it's like nails on a chalkboard and you hear that word used?
Nothing at all, actually. I know that's not an exciting answer.
No, no, that's okay.
I can't think of one word that just makes me cringe.
All right. We're almost done.
No, keep them coming. This is
fun. You like it? Okay.
Yeah.
If you were challenged to a duel, what weapon would you choose?
A glove. Like, I know it's... Yeah, like, to me, that's the classic duel weapon. And if you're going to be in a duel, it might as well be, like, fun or funny.
So is the duel with the glove, or is that how you challenge someone to it?
So, yeah, I'm pretty sure you're right about that.
But you lose pretty quick if the other guy...
But that instantly makes it more funny when they say, choose your weapon, and you're like, well, I did already. Like, why do you think I slapped you with my glove?
That's, so you just have a glove fight.
Yeah.
Okay. If you were a wrestler, what would your finishing move be?
Oh, I mean, assuming it's... Okay, this is kind of a wrestling nerd answer.
Yeah.
Assuming it's something I can't actually be capable of doing in real life, it would be a Phoenix Splash, just because of how sick that move looks. It's so awesome.
How many spins is that?
I don't know how many. I think it's a full spin and a rotation.
Huh?
Yeah, it's really awesome. It's a very cool move. Seth Rollins uses it once in a while, and some of the newer guys, you know, they... It's beautiful, though. Look
it's
it
beautiful
up
move.
If you haven't seen it. It's just absolutely stunning, yeah.
Who would you put as your favorite? Oh, you told me before, but
he's
your favorite wrestler of all time.
So, Mick Foley is my favorite, but I think that Chris Jericho is the best of all time.
Oh, really?
I think he's better than Ric Flair. I think he's better than Austin. I think, to me, he's at the very top of...
I like that.
Can't get better than that.
I like that answer. Why? Why would you put him at the top?
Just because he did... Okay. Sorry if I'm... Like,
no, no.
Nerd out about
keep
this.
Keep going.
So he was in ECW, WCW, WWF, WWE. He's in NJPW, just had a match last weekend. He's done it all. He reached the top without drug and alcohol problems.
True.
But he still partied and had fun. He was responsible. He had a family. He has kids. He maintained a very healthy relationship. He wasn't in and out of wives and divorcing and, like, you know, all that stuff.
He beat Bill Goldberg in a fight.
He kicked Goldberg's ass. Yeah, that's another really good one. He was in a rock. Is in a rock
He's
band.
In a rock band.
He's just done it all. He always had a plan B. He was, you know, responsible. He kept his nose clean, and he's a very good wrestler.
Yeah,
he's
true.
Cut a promo like nobody else. Stands up to Vince.
Yeah.
To me, he's everything that you want in a wrestler with a long-term plan.
Yeah, no, you know, That's a good breakdown. How he put himself over in WCW
for sure
was pretty impressive, especially at a time when everything was very NWO centric.
That's right. Yeah,
and he really had to put himself out there to be remembered,
and he did. Like WCW stuff with his whale spell, his hairdo, and Ralphus. Like all that stuff is so memorable.
And it came over to WWF at the time with that same level of importance.
Everyone knew who he was when he showed up, and his first feud was with The Rock. What the hell?
Right? That was a great first appearance.
For sure, it was. Very memorable. So, you know, best. Yeah.
What's something that can't be found or bought on the internet?
A healthy relationship. Which might sound a little silly, but...
Break it down.
Yeah, no,
some people could say eHarmony.
Sure.
Not to say you're wrong.
That's not something I'd considered, though, so I'm glad that you brought that up.
Because I thought the same thing when I read that question. Like, you can't get, like, real love.
Right.
But some people be like, we met on efficiency.
Yeah, you absolutely can. And I actually know people who have found, like, very long-lasting, happy relationships using those dating sites. Yeah, you know what? That's a very interesting question. About 8 months ago, I would have said Deleter Screen Tone, which is an art supply, which I could not find anywhere for very long. Even on Amazon, I couldn't find it. But then I found it like 4 months ago, so I can't say that one. I'm just going to take like 2 seconds to think about this. And that's actually a very good question. Can't be found online. What have other people answered? Out of curiosity.
I don't know. These are just interesting questions that I found and put together.
Hmm.
But that one, I was like, it stumped me too, because I'm like, oh, that's easy. I'm like, wait a second, you can find pretty much anything.
You can find almost anything online. You can't find... Well, if you're in America, net neutrality, since that's basically been abolished. I mean, not 100% yet, but the motion's, like, it's all but confirmed, unfortunately. So I'm going to say to my, you know, American friends, net neutrality. It's just not something that, I don't know, it sucks, it's awful, and it was a very bad decision by very unhelpful people, but that's the way it went. Are you familiar with any of that stuff?
I've been hearing about it. I heard the explanation of it once before, but I'm a little bit unclear about all of the parameters.
Right, yeah, there's so much to it right now, but the meat and potatoes of it is that it's essentially going into effect, unless there's a miracle that takes place and stops it from happening, but it could very well ruin the internet and internet freedoms in America.
And so it's not going to affect us here in Canada?
Well,
yet?
Yet, now with Ford. Yeah, well, I mean, that's only Ontario, but I'm pretty sure Trudeau has said that net neutrality is important and there's no plans to even discuss abolishing it. So as long as he does his job, which hopefully he will, we will be fine. Which, I mean, we're fine right now, so really we can only be happy about that.
Right. Yeah. My answer to that question would be, after talking with you, hard work.
Oh man. Oh, that seems like a
no, and it's not to sound like, ooh, that's so clever, but
for sure.
You can find people that are talented, you can find anything you want, but you can't learn discipline or buy it on
yeah, the web, you absolutely right? can. I wish that was my answer.
No, net neutrality was a good one. This is a weird question. Maybe you don't want to hit. What's the weirdest thing that has happened to you in a car?
In a car.
You don't have have to answer it if you don't want to.
No, I'm sad that I can't think of, like, I'm sad that nothing pops into my head immediately, because now it makes me think, like, how exciting has my life been? Okay. That, like, there's nothing that's happening.
You don't have to have an exciting life by making weird things happen.
For sure.
Maybe it's a good thing.
Yeah, maybe it is a good thing. I got nothing for that one. I can't think of a single weird thing that's happened in a car.
Everything's been normal, just the way it should be.
Yeah, sure.
There you go. There you go. What villain do you really feel for?
Interesting. So, this is kind of topical. I'm sure if I had time to think, but since this is off the top of my head, Thanos from Infinity War.
Yeah.
He was the star of that movie for me.
Yeah.
He just killed it, and I felt bad. Like, at the end of the movie, I was like, oh, I hope he does eradicate half of mankind. I hope that he does it, because he's clearly very adamant about this, and maybe I'm being selfish by thinking that, you know, the world needs this many humans. Like, maybe he's right about all this, and, you know, maybe he is. Like, we haven't seen the second part.
No.
Maybe we see the world and it's actually a better place.
Yeah.
You know, like, who knows? But I really felt for him. Like, the writers did such an amazing job. The actors.
That's a sign of a good villain.
Exactly. If you don't feel for the villain, it doesn't matter. You'll never become attached to them. Another one who I'll say is, have you seen The Last Airbender at all? One of the characters is called Prince Zuko. If anyone who's seen The Last Airbender knows who that is, you'll know why I chose him.
Yeah. I like those. Those are good. You could fit your whole life into one picture. What would it look like?
That's an interesting question, too. It would have a lot of blue and green in it, I think. I spent a lot of time outdoors as a kid. So, and even today, as much as I can, try to get outside as often as I can. I'm a big fan of the trails here in the city, as sparse as they are. They're fun to hit up whenever I can. Sometimes I'll bring my work outside, just find a nice spot under the shade to ink or paint. So, whatever it is, there would be a lot of blue and green in there. And that's all I know about that.
So we'll put a pin in it there.
Cool.
And the next time you come on, I'll try to. You know what I want to do? I'd like to get you and Mike Ruth in a room just to talk wrestling.
Oh man, like,
he's a huge wrestling fan.
I need that to happen immediately. Okay. Like, it has to happen.
All right, we'll figure that out.
Please,
I know he can go on about wrestling more than you probably can about comics.
I can be the same way.
And I think it would be a very good wrestling episode.
And I think it would be a lot of fun. I think it would just be a blast hanging out and talking wrestling.
Well,
anytime.
It was a blast having you on the show.
Yeah,
so I'm happy it happened, and we're going to get you back on soon.
Absolutely.
What's the next thing you're working on?
So I'm working on a book called Ogre that's going to be out by Source Point Press.
Okay.
That's going to be in previews this summer, August, I believe.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it's awesome. And it will be released in October, the first issue. I'm just wrapping up the second issue right now, but you can read it in October, pre-order it in previews. That siren goes.
Oh, no,
sorry.
Yeah, okay. I can still hear you. Just
okay, cool. I'm working on a Canadian history comic about the Shiners War of the 1800s, which isn't something that's talked about in schools very often, but it's about a small war between Irish immigrants and the Montreal government. True story, it happened in Montreal back in the 1800s when the Rideau Canal was being built. So it's kind of like a biographical comic that will be out later this year. It's called The Shiners War, and then working on more Bridge Builders stuff whenever I get a chance. As a follow-up to Terraquil as well. I'm drawing, I'm in the layouts process for a story written by Fearless Fred from The Edge right now.
Right.
Which will most likely also be released by Source Point. And then I'm drawing a story called A Better Place, about a young kid who loses his grandfather and decides that he's going to go find him because he doesn't understand that his grandfather is dead. He just thinks his grandfather is out there somewhere doing something. His parents weren't exactly honest with him. They said grandpa's gone for a little while. I'm not writing it, but I am drawing it. And it's being written by a really awesome guy named Dwayne Murray, who's a stand-up guy. And there's actually going to be a few really neat surprises in this book I can't talk about.
Okay.
I'll tell you after.
That's fine. Sounds good.
But yeah, anyway, sorry to ramble.
I'm intrigued by this. It sounds great.
It's going to be a lot of fun, and it's right up my alley, too. Okay. When he pitched this to me, I knew I had to jump on it immediately. So that's in the layout stage right now. That'll be out in 2019. And I think that's it. There's also music projects and a whole bunch of other stuff, but
you're a busy boy.
What's that?
You're a busy boy.
I like to work, yeah. If you're interested, tweet at me, and I'll tell you everything, no problem.
What's the tweet?
It's just Sean Daly, all one word.
The real Sean Daly.
That's it. It's Sean Daly.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So thank you, everybody, for listening. You can reach us at caveofsolitude.com, on Facebook, on Instagram, as well as caveofsolitude at Outlook. Did I say that already? No. At Outlook.com, you can email us. Thank you again for everybody for listening. Thank you, Sean Daly, for being on the show. And we will be back soon.
Sounds good. Thank you.